This week's Pseudopod is brought to you by Audible.com. Go to audible.com/podcast to claim your free audiobook. Pseudopod 116, November 14th, 2008. This week's story, Sick Day, by Michael Chant. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Michael Chant, last seen here with Faith in Sips and Bites. Your narrator this week is Ellie Hirschman of Darker Projects. So, before we go any further, stop and ask yourself this one surprisingly complex question. Is there such a thing as wrong fun? Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Sick Day, by Michael Chant. As she leaves for work, my wife kisses me goodbye. It is love in the machine, passion stripped away on the assembly line known as the work week. Her car pulls out of the driveway, leaving me with more than an hour to kill before I have to go to work. I empty a little plastic bag of capsules and gel caps into my palm. These are all the vitamins a man my age should be taking. I wash them down with a glass of calcium-enriched orange juice, and then it's time to shower. While lathering up, masturbation gets considered and rejected. The pleasure I would receive is found to be too fleeting to affect my mood. After rinsing and drying off, I pause to look at my face in the bathroom mirror. Seeing is believing. I look older than I am. Then it's into the bathroom to dress. B-plus's dress code is business casual. Today's wardrobe consists of light tan khakis, a white button shirt, and a nondescript navy blue tie. I slip into the shirt and try to ignore the dull carpal tunnel syndrome ache in my right wrist as I button it up. My coworkers call this pain mouse hand. I save the top button for last because I hate buttoning the top button. After my pants are on, I give myself the once-over in the full-length bedroom mirror and see someone who almost looks like a Boating Plus customer service rep. Last week's memo said that guys have to wear ties. Neuron search parties comb the relevance, trying to understand why it is important for me to wear a tie for people whom I deal with exclusively on the phone. Our customers, the marina mechanics, and the fishing boating retailers never see me, and the ones I see around the shore never wear ties. Seconds creep by as I relive the day before, and the day before, and the day before. The last time the world really noticed me is a missing file, lost and declared dead. The realization is like a punch in the abdomen, winding me and stirring a memory from my college days. I used to work nights at the local multiplex, cleaning up the theaters after the last showing. One night, after every soul had left the building, I sat in one of the theaters with the doors closed. I had read somewhere that silence could be loud and wanted to hear it for myself, so I sat there for a few minutes without making a sound. At first, it sounded like the rumble of a far-off train. Then it bloomed into the roar of an angry god. The noise was so massive and terrifying that I didn't stand it for very long. I ran out of there screaming. It took more than a few games in the lobby's arcade to ground me again. Deserting the tie, I flee the bedroom. My mind types the memo. Skipping the tie is not enough. The feeling is palpable, that itchy energy kids get before they put on their costumes to go trick-or-treating. That pure desire to shed reality and freak out the world for an hour or two. I go with it, looting the kitchen cabinets of Karo syrup and red food coloring. The blender turns a sinister shade of red as the two liquids puree. I cannot recall the last time I was this focused. I don't let myself dwell on that thought for long. The coffee maker's clock is the bearer of good news. I can get to work early if I hustle. Our just-in-case-the-air-conditioner-breaks-again fan stirs up dust bunnies as I yank it from the closet. I stuff my wallet and keys in my pockets and turn off the blender to check the red stuff's consistency. It is perfect. The syrup bottle and the food coloring are returned to their respective places. Me, the blender's pitcher, and the fan head for the door. Once outside, I set the pitcher on the welcome mat and plug the fan into the duplex's only outdoor socket. From the trunk of my car, I remove the gallon of water stashed there in case my car ever overheats. The water goes beside the pitcher. This is the moment of truth, the point of no return, and all the other cliches you can think of. The adult in me hesitates, second-guessing this desperate attack on my routine. I take that last deep breath. I splash fake blood all over me. After throwing several handfuls of the sticky red fluid onto myself, I turn on the fan and pitch globs of it into the whirling blades. The blood splatters back at me, speckling the parts untouched by wet hands. The pitcher is soon out of handfuls to grab. I pour the remainder onto my head. The great lake makes streams down my body. Then the fan and the pitcher are neatly placed in the garbage can and covered with the lid. The water does a decent job of washing away the excess blood near the welcome mat. To keep my sweat from making the blood runny, I drive to work with my windows down. It takes an enormous effort to contain my glee and a lot of discipline to not make eye contact with the other commuters along the way. The first shock is not for them. Pulling into B-Plus's parking lot, I see my boss getting out of his car. It's better than I hoped. I won't even have to get out of my car. I pull up close, put on my poker face, and, for the first time that I can remember, I call him by his first name. He turns and gets an eyeful and says, "Jesus Christ!" I keep it deadpan and tell him that my name is not Jesus Christ. His body language is contradictory, slowly advancing, but clearly not wanting to. The look on his face wonders if I have spent the morning running a chainsaw through my neighbors. He asks if I'm all right. The answer, "I'm not feeling well. I need to take a sick day." I offer to get a doctor's note if my doctor can squeeze me in today. Then I put the car in reverse and back out of B-Plus's lot. He says and does nothing to stop me. A couple miles away, the laughter is released, and it is a lot like releasing a caged animal back into the wild. The temptation to go home and enjoy the rest of the day on the couch is hard to resist, but I do it. This one stupid act has set me free, and it is something that should be shared. My eyes bounce from windshield to rearview mirror. 5 cars have swerved after passing me, no doubt rubbernecking at the bloody man in the driver's seat. I continue to hold off making eye contact with anyone. Turning into the suburb in which I grew up, the prognosis is severe. Children will leave their youth here when they become adults. Perhaps today a difference can be made. I park about a block from my old elementary school. My first classroom was in the front of the building. I walk straight for it. As I get closer, I see a pretty young woman instructing a class full of kindergartners. A few children turn their bored heads and take a gander. The drizzle becomes a downpour. I quickly claim the whole class's attention. There is no fear, just quiet awe at first. That unrefined sense of wonder in the face of the incomprehensible, that which we lose when we age. I go right up to the window and peer inside. The kids are out of their seats, pointing and jabbering. A little girl starts crying. The teacher is as white as her chalk. I lock eyes with one boy in the back of the rest, who is just standing there, grinning, warming my heart with the knowledge that I have touched at least one kindred soul. The teacher starts frantically speaking into the intercom box on the wall. Today's lesson is over. I do not smile or wave or say goodbye, but I do leave in a hurry. The tires shriek. The school and the tiny suburb around it shrink into my mirrors. I feel completely exhilarated. The next destination isn't scheduled yet, but as the law of averages would have it, I hit a red light. A rotund woman in a station wagon cruises to a halt in the lane beside me. She is the first driver I look at directly, but she doesn't notice me. She is applying eyeliner. I briefly wonder if there are statistics somewhere for the number of women who have poked out an eye while applying eyeliner in a moving vehicle. I tire of being ignored. I honk the horn and yell, "Hey, lady!" She finally sees me, and a small yelp gets caught in her double chin. I ask her if she wants to hear what I did today. She is speechless. The light turns green. My car advances. Hers does not. Despite the number of car horns blaring behind her, she waits for me to get a good distance in front of her. She takes the first turn and disappears from my mirrors. It occurs to me that she may have used that makeup pencil to scribble down my license plate number. My tour is coming to an end. Under the orders of a grumbling stomach, I stop in at the first deli on the way home. The old man behind the counter is too engrossed in his newspaper to pay me any mind. I grab a small box of donuts, utterly aware that the last cholesterol screening put these sinful little creations on the "do not have" list that my doctor gave me. The decaf is bypassed for the real thing, 20 scalding ounces of the battery acid I used to drink every day. The front page of the Gazette sticks to my shirt as I tuck it under my arm and head for the counter. Still in the grip of the screaming headlines, the old man works the cash register without noticing me or the curious red stains on my goods. The thought occurs, "I hope he remembered to take his heart medicine today." He sees me on his second take, and his second take is with his eyes wide and his jaw hanging open. The "what the hell happened to you" comes out so fast it almost sounds like another language. on the spot the decision is made. He is too old to benefit from my experience. All he can take from this encounter is an interesting work story. My appearance is blamed on the scourge of the elderly, the young. I tell him I run the drama club at the high school, and that we were rehearsing Julius Caesar, that the kid playing Brutus got a little carried away with the fake blood during the stabbing scene. I peel a $10 bill from my hand and slap it on the counter. The old man takes the money like he's handling a dead mouse and says, "Serves you right. All I hear about anymore is violence in the schools, and you eggheads go and put on a play with a stabbing scene? Don't make a lick of sense." I almost say that it is Shakespeare, and being Shakespeare, it is worth the violence. I almost tell him that the play is ripe with important life lessons. It dawns on me that saying anything of the sort would just be in the defense of a lie that has already lost its novelty. I tell him to keep the change. On the way to the car, two yellow jackets buzz about me. One of them lands and starts sucking up the syrup. The irony earns a chuckle. These winged nuisances have brains smaller than belly button lint, and know the deal. My own species has 3 pounds of thinking tissue and can't figure me out. For their superior wisdom, I do not kill them, but I do shoo them away before getting in the car and rolling up the windows. After drinking all the coffee and eating half the donuts, my bowels are not amused. I get the feeling that today's me has worn out his welcome. Besides, the fake blood is starting to itch. Turning down my street, I see my wife's car in the driveway. I am beyond impressed. She took on a new job about 3 months ago. I never got around to changing the "In case of emergency, notify" card in my employee file. I must have really rattled my boss to get him to track down her new work number. I drive by the duplex. I don't want her to hear me pulling in. The empty lot on the other side of the block is as good a place as any to go. I chuck the remaining donuts into the tall weeds for the birds and ants. The sections of newspaper draped over the splattered upholstery look like the work of an amateur assassin, but it will have to do for now. I power walk home, wondering if my boss called the police as well. As quietly as possible, I unlock the door and enter the living room. My wife rounds the corner of the kitchen with a cordless phone to her ear. It's on her face as loud as a strip club's billboard. I have gone too far. She tells whoever she's talking to that I'm home and she'll call back later. Dropping the phone and lunging forward, she scans me for wounds her eyes will never find. She stops looking for injuries, examining instead my grin, my stance, and my stare. I interrupt her search for the killer she never dreamed I'd be by asking her how her day was. She says, "Jesus Christ, what's wrong with you?" I tell her calmly that my name isn't Jesus Christ. I tell her that I've had a pretty weird day, that wherever I went, I couldn't shake the feeling that I was being watched. There's nothing in her posture that says she appreciates my statement. Lamentably, she represses all those feelings I see squirming beneath her adult skin. They're vivid, the urge to scream or slap me or run or throw something at me. She's too freaked out to compute anything other than an answer to her question. Unfortunately, explaining what I've done will suck some of the life out of it, and I'm not prepared to do that just yet. Gambling with our marriage, I tell her I need to take a shower. She probably thinks I can't hear her fingers pounding the numbers on the phone while the water's running. The words are gibberish, but her tone says enough. I pity her, driven over the edge by something as superficial as a sight gag. The call is short. The bedroom door opens. There is rummaging in the closets and drawers. A trail of stomping ends with the slam of the duplex's door. It takes close to an hour to wash all the blood off. Before drying off, I use my towel to wipe the steam off the mirror. Seeing is believing, I look younger than I am. The silence hits me when I step out of the bathroom, but it is nothing like the time in the theater. It's actually cozy. The bedroom has been ransacked. A good portion of her clothes and our baby blue suitcase are missing. There's a hastily scribbled note on the bed. I skim it, mentally highlighting phrases like "can't go on like this," and "melancholy," and "you're a stranger to me anymore," and "counseling." It ends with her staying at her mother's until I agree to get help. I resist the urge to call her up to say something stupid like, "Most men become alcoholics or have affairs. Would you rather I did something like that?" I resist the urge to explain that what she saw today was not an alien bursting out of its human host, that it's the other way around. The conclusion stops me. She is one of them, the unready. Perhaps with time she will understand. Perhaps one day she will seek me out as a teacher. The clock says the afternoon is just beginning. I dress in sweats and throw today's clothes in the trash. I may be younger now, but I still know permanent stains when I see them. I throw enough clothes for a few days into a duffel bag and grab a couple beach towels to lay over the syrup and papers stuck to the seat. I come back for the blender. At the supermarket, I fill a shopping cart with easy meals, Karo syrup, and red food coloring. I rent a room at the motel a few miles from the duplex and drop off my groceries. At the nearest toy store, I buy one of those gigantic water pistol rifles and 6 refill bottles for it. I have a few sick days left, plenty of time to share with others just how easy it is to pull the rug out from under this mean old world.
You learn to make your own fun growing up in a place like the Isle of Man. The island, once memorably described as 100,000 alcoholics clinging to a rock, is, it's fair to say, on the small side, and as a result, you tend to have to get a little creative, or desperate, depending on your point of view, or which part of it you live on. I've talked before about the Beast of St. John's Plantation, actually a friend of mine with 2 laser pointers strapped to his glasses and some booger booger noises, and the unintentional but thankfully not permanently scarring plastic petrol bomb unpleasantness. Likewise, the Zorro sign that turned out to be exactly 4 hazard lights wide and may, or may not, have been placed in the same field as something really very dubious indeed. I've not, as yet, talked about things like the time a friend of mine decided to find out what effect heating had on the contact explosive from a 2-2 rifle round. Short answer, bang, ouch. Or the toaster cannon, or why the phrase up on the hill always makes me smile. There were incidents too, some of which exist in what I like to call the Dukes of Hazzard spectrum of legality, as in just some good old boys never meaning no harm, although no rivers were jumped in Pete's car, that I know of. Although I may have blocked that out, but all of them come in part from the basic adolescent desire to mess with the rest of the planet, and in part from boredom. Sometimes, as Mr. Darko once said, you just have to break things to see what it feels like. And sometimes, you just have to find out what it feels like to drive very fast in a car somewhere where the mud flaps are actually being used as the brakes. I know how that feels. I don't ever need to feel that again. Of course, sometimes, more often as time goes by, you also really have to sit on the sofa eating cheese on toast and watching Stargate, or that may just be me. Anyway, let's talk about Metatropolis. It's a shared world audiobook anthology, which should already have got your attention. Then, there's the fact it's a series of stories exploring the way a city dies, and what happens when it does. What happens after the end of normal society. Not sold yet? How about if I tell you the authors involved are Jay Lake, John Scalzi, Elizabeth Baer, Tobias Bakel, and Carl Schroeder, who are, without a shadow of a doubt, 5 of the best writers working today. Still no? Okay, well, as well as veteran audiobook narrators Stefan Rudnicki and Scott Brick, the voice cast also includes Michael Hogan, Alessandro Giuliani, and Candice McClure. Or, to put it another way, Saul Tai, Felix Gaiter, and Anastasia Dweller. It's available now from Audible, and it is absolutely magnificent. Money, money, money must be funny in the rich man's world, except it probably isn't at the moment, and the rich man's world is kind of hurtling down towards everybody else's world quite fast. But hey, how else was I going to work an ABBA reference in there? Anyway, donations are what we rely on to pay our authors, because they still don't accept handwritten tokens with "We love you" written on them, the cheapskates. So, if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you won't regret it, and I promise they will appreciate it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod would like to point out, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then chances are it's a duck with a meat cleaver.